All right. Well, today we're going to talk about science as a God-created good. And that's a pretty big claim that we're making as Christians, because there's a lot of people who claim that Christianity is anti-science. And so we're going to talk about how that is not the case. Science is a God-created good. Now, I'm going to remind you of something that we talked about a long, long time ago, all the way back at the beginning of the summer. You all remember the two-story view? You got the church up on top, the house down below. And that was basically an illustration of the most common paradigm that our secular culture works off of, and that is to split the sacred and the secular into two different categories and to try to keep them compartmentalized off, and the sacred should have no say to the secular. The secular is basically supposedly neutral, and the sacred is biased. The sacred is this private sphere. It's just your subjective personal preferences. And the lower story, well, that's the scientific stuff. That's objective knowledge. And the upper story, that's just, you know, your own choices. What's right for you is right for you. What's right for somebody else is right for them, whatever. But in science, that's the facts. That's binding on everybody. And faith, spiritual stuff, that's just non-rational. Faith is just this giant leap of blindness. And in the scientific world, that's rational, that's verifiable. That's basically the paradigm that our secular world works off of. So that's kind of what scientism grows out of, that paradigm. We're going to talk about what scientism is. And this is not a definition from Christians or believers. This is from the New Oxford American Dictionary. They actually define it for us, what it is. It is excessive belief. Notice that they even recognize that this is a belief, which is interesting since these scientists are so much against faith and belief. But scientism is the excessive belief in the power of scientific knowledge and techniques. And more specifically, basically it is the idolizing or worshiping of science. Science is all there is. We don't need anything else for our knowledge. And really, if you run into somebody who thinks that all knowledge comes only from science, the first thing you should challenge them on is, oh, you don't recognize philosophy? Philosophy is not a legitimate discipline. Only science is a legitimate discipline. We only get knowledge from science. We don't get knowledge from philosophy. And what you should understand, when they say that Christianity has no place in science, basically what they're saying is philosophy has no place in science, because Christianity, theology, is simply philosophy. Theology is answering all of the philosophical questions based on biblical revelation. But Christianity and what we're doing when we talk about our Christian principles in relation to science, we're basically answering philosophical questions from a biblical worldview perspective. But scientism is the idolizing or worshiping of science. And really, when we talk about their definition of science, what they presuppose is actually not necessarily science. It's naturalism, which they equate with science. So that's what scientism is. And you've probably heard these claims before. Faith is the great cop-out, the great excuse to evade the need to think and evaluate evidence. That's from Richard Dawkins. Oh, Christianity is anti-science. Science and religion are in conflict. Religion undermines science. Faith is blind. Religion causes war. Secularism, that is science and technology, brings salvation. These are the common claims that you'll hear from people who believe in scientism. And scientism is, in fact, a religion. They have philosophical assumptions, just like we have philosophical assumptions. We get our philosophical assumptions from the Bible. They get their philosophical assumptions from humanism. So to debunk scientism, first of all, there needs to be a right definition of what faith actually is, because one of their foundational criticisms of us is that faith is blind. And that really, it's a straw man argument that they have against faith. They have a different definition of faith than a legitimate definition of faith. They tend to think that faith is just this emotional, I'll believe it, whatever, even if there's no evidence. But really, true faith involves the mind. There is rational content that your intellect understands in biblical faith, and the object of your faith is really what's most important. We don't just have faith in faith. It's faith in a particular object, content, which includes biblical revelation. It includes our affections, which is the bent of our spirit that accepts something or not. It involves our will. It's a choice that we submit to a particular authority source. And all of these things are true of those who believe in scientism as well. They have an authority source that they depend on. And I would insist that it's not all inductive discovery by their own observations. They make a giant leap of faith. They make an assumption in an authority source when you take them all the way back to their starting assumptions. And we'll talk about that a little bit later. Faith really is inescapable as long as humans are finite and fallible. So if you're a scientist, can you be in all places, all at once, all at the same time, with perfect knowledge without ever making a mistake of your observations? No, nobody can do that. So they have to make assumptions. They have to trust in an authority source. Faith is inescapable even for them. They make philosophical assumptions. The object of their faith can be a variety of things. It can be rationalism, and their faith is that human logic is sufficient. Now, Christianity doesn't deny logic. Again, this is another straw man. Oh, you have faith. That means you oppose logic. No, we include logic in our philosophy, in what we believe in the Bible. But the big question is human logic sufficient? Is that all you need? And so this is the question is, yes, human logic is necessary, but is it sufficient? Is it enough? Is it all that there is? So, and they make a giant leap and say, yes, human logic, that's all that's sufficient. Well, that's what they can't prove with science. They're making a giant leap of faith themselves. Others say the object of their faith is empiricism, that is, using your five senses. And they say that human observation is sufficient. And the big question is, well, is it sufficient? Yes, we agree it's necessary. When we say that we have faith in revelation, we aren't ruling out empirical means of observation to understand things. We think it's necessary. But is it sufficient? Another one, the object of their faith is in existentialism, which is just a big, huge word that means their experience, their own experience. Well, this is what I've experienced, and that's how I know it's true. Now, all of these things Christians include in their worldview as necessary. Our experience is necessary. Our observation is necessary. Our logic is necessary. But how do we know that our observation is accurate? How do we know that our logic is accurate? How do we know that our experience is accurate? And we rely on something that transcends all of these things, and it's biblical revelation, which guides us to understand whether we're logically understanding things correctly. And they themselves, the secularists, they have something that transcends all these things too. It's a philosophy, and it's a philosophy that's called humanism. They rely on the collective knowledge of humans, and they think that the collective knowledge of humans is sufficient. And we would say, well, the collective knowledge of humans is helpful, but not necessarily sufficient because we are fallible, we are finite, we can't be in all places all at the same time, observing everything perfectly without mistake. Therefore, none of these things are sufficient, even though they are necessary. Scientism says that these things are sufficient. And it's faith. They take this on faith. They cannot prove it scientifically that those things are sufficient. Now, the key question for naturalism is this. Where does everything come from, including the laws of science? How do they know that their laws of science are reliable? And where do those laws come from? And they really cannot answer that without depending on a philosophy, without depending on faith. And our answer to them is that laws have to come from lawgivers, as any theist can tell you. That's where laws come from. If you think back to our second session on apologetics, this series of questions that I'm going to pull up in just a second is an example of what you do when you go on the offensive. Many times we're on the defensive, where they're challenging us. and saying, wow, faith is the great cop-out. You guys just don't even think rationally. Okay, well, let's look at your worldview house. Let's go into your worldview house. Destroy all their furniture. They have no leg to rest on after you go through these questions. And then you can bring them into your worldview house and say, you know what? Our worldview house really does have rationality to it, but our rationality is based on revelation rather than human autonomy. So here's a series of questions to ask them. Why is there something rather than nothing? Why did the Big Bang occur? What caused it? Where did the exploding material come from? How does order come from disorder without an external mechanism directing it? Why would it make sense to trust brains that were supposedly formed by blind processes of natural selection that's nothing more than stardust? Where do the laws of logic or the laws of science come from, and what ensures their consistency? How does life come from non-life? What is the reliable standard for justifying something as right or wrong? Science cannot answer any of these questions. You have to depend or smuggle in philosophical assumptions into your science in order to understand or answer any of these questions. Science is limited. It cannot give us all the knowledge of life. It gives us some knowledge. It helps us do some things, but it is not absolute, and it does not have the total... it's not absolute. Another challenge to scientism is this book that was written, and you can't really see it, but it's an Oxford... it's written by Oxford Press, so it's not a Christian book. I'm not even sure if this author is a Christian. But he debunks the widespread myth of history that the believers in scientism believe in. Believers in scientism will often tell you that there's this conflict between religion and scientists that goes all the way back into the Middle Ages, the 16 and 1700s especially, where you had secularists who were trying to advance the truths of science, and they were opposed by religionists who tried to squelch them and keep them down from making their scientific advances. Galileo is one that they always appeal to as, oh, the church was so mean to Galileo, and they wouldn't let him do his scientific observations. And this author, Principe, says that's just a total myth. What you had is you had religious people who were seeking to make scientific discoveries who were in conflict with other religious people. It was a conflict between two groups of religious people, and they had their reasons for being in conflict, but it was nothing to do with religionists versus non-religionists. Now, so all of that is kind of a preview introduction. You have people who claim that Christianity is anti-science, and that is just not true. And Dennis is going to talk about scientism a whole lot more next week. My main goal this week is to talk about the creational good that science is, that God wants us to do science. God created us to do it. He's not anti-science. And science really goes all the way back to the creation mandate. And I just want to read a little paragraph from the book here once I catch up on my slides, that makes this connection. Remember we made this connection between the creation mandate and culture. Culture is simply the outgrowth of doing what you need to do to fulfill the creation mandate. The creation mandate includes subduing the earth, developing it. And so science is just part of that part of culture where we are subduing, we're being good stewards over our world. If humans are to properly take care of the earth, they must study the earth, which is the work of science, and then cultivate and develop it according to its best use, which is the work of technology. As knowledge increases and techniques become standardized, specific disciplines of study and fields of work spring up. Since Old Testament Israel was an agrarian society, they worked in agriculture, that kind of dominion is most often emphasized in Scripture. But dominion is far more expansive than just the primary industries of agriculture, fishing, forestry, and mining. Secondary industries of construction, manufacturing should also be included. As the nation advances, it adds tertiary industries of infrastructure, trade, finance, general services, and government. In addition, the well-rounded person participates in the humanities and fine arts.
The New Testament assumes all this labor is going on and provides principles for doing our work in a godly, that is, ethical, and Christian manner, that is, following creational norms. So remember, we talked about creational norms a few weeks ago, and that simply describes this is how God designed the world to function. And we have structure, that's God's design, his creational norms. We have direction that's either away from God's norms, it's twisted, it's fallen, or we have direction that's pushing back towards God's creational norms, how he designed this world and how it should function, and that's living in light of redemption. So science is all about fulfilling our creation mandate. God designed us for this, and we're supposed to do it according to creational norms. So the rest of the session, and I have about 13 minutes to do this, we want to answer these questions. What is science? What are the assumptions that make science possible? And I'm talking about our Christian assumptions. Science is not Christianity is not anti-science. Actually, the assumptions of Christianity make science possible. And it's the secularist who has to borrow from our Christian assumptions in order to do their work. In order to fulfill the creation mandate, doing science, they actually steal from our worldview. It's by God's common grace that he allows them to do this. But it's Christianity that makes science possible, not secularism. So what are the purposes for doing science? What are the creational norms? What was God's design for doing science well? Well, let me just give you an informal definition first. Science is just the label we give to some of the most useful methods of subduing creation and ruling over it, the creation mandate, which we just talked about. And those methods didn't get invented in 1900 and didn't get invented in 1600 in the Enlightenment. They began in seed form in the Garden of Eden before the fall. This is what humans started engaging in as soon as they started developing the world and fulfilling the creation mandate. Now, there is a formal definition. And I'm not saying that this is the only definition or even the best definition. This is a definition from one of our junior high or high school science textbooks that we brought into our worldview textbook. Science is the collection of observations. Again, we're not against empiricism. Empiricism might not be sufficient, but it is necessary. So science is the collection of observations, explanations. We use logic. And models, that's the philosophy that you plug your data in to interpret it, produced through an organized study of nature for the purpose of enabling people to exercise good and wise dominion over God's world for the glory of God and the good of mankind. So what are the Christian assumptions that make this work of science possible? Well, the first assumption is that nature is orderly, Genesis 8:22. In science, you have to have an orderly nature in order to do anything with it. It has to be predictable. Science presupposes that this world is predictable. Now, how does the evolutionary story, which is random, how does that assumption, how do you do science if this world is just random? It's the Christian assumption that God created this world, and he created it according to scientific laws. And the world is orderly. It has predictability. So orderly means that we should expect some uniformity where we can track things, compare things, and try to figure out why things are different. This is different from uniformitarianism, which I don't have time to get into. We do allow for miracles, but miracles are unique. It's not normal. Suspending the laws of nature is what a true miracle is. So we do not believe in uniformitarianism where, we just look at the world today and drip, 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 drip. Oh, look, rock layers form over millions of years. Now, there are catastrophes like a giant flood, and Mount St. Helens that just blew up in the 1980s. And you can see canyons that were formed in a matter of hours with hundreds and millions of layers of rocks, and you didn't have to wait millions of years for it. We can assume that this universe is governed by laws, and evolution cannot explain where these laws come from or why they work the way they do consistently in a random universe. We can believe that this universe is sustained by God's providence. And again, miracles are an exception. Another assumption is that humans are capable. The human mind is capable of creatively describing the predictable natural order in useful ways. And why is this? Because we're created in the image of God. And in the image of God, we have all of these creative capacities. And in the evolutionary story, they cannot
even explain why we have personality. Why do we have the traits of personhood with the capacities that we have? If we just came from stardust and stardust evolved into us, how do you get from non-life, impersonal stardust to poof? Oh, all of a sudden we have capacities of personhood. They have no scientific mechanism of explaining how that happened. They just wave their wand and say, it just is. It just happened. We're here now. And yeah, but explain it scientifically. They have no way to explain it. But in the Christian worldview, we have human minds. We're patterned after the divine mind. And that's how we explain personhood, because we were created by our Creator. So God's creations should be understandable. We should be able to look at this world, because we're made in God's image, and understand not his mind comprehensively, but because we're created in his image and he's revealed himself, we can understand a little bit of how his mind works, and so we can understand his creation. Science relies on the predictability of the natural world, yet it thrives on something that's unpredictable, and that's human creativity. So humans are capable of discovering new ways to use the predictability of the natural order. Another Christian assumption is that humans have a right to use nature. And you have quite a bit of a conflict in the secular world on scientists who want to do this work and versus environmentalists who, I don't know if that work should be done, because what's ultimate? Why should humans be ultimate? Well, in the biblical worldview, human beings have the right and the responsibility to rearrange nature in order to meet their needs. Now, they need to be good stewards. They should not be destructive. But how do you determine what's destructive, and how do you have wisdom to know whether you should do what you're doing? Well, God gave humans dominion over the earth as wise stewards who care for the earth and love other humans. And we look at what we're doing and we say, is this loving to other humans? Is this good stewardship of the earth? And, you know, you have environmentalists who borrow those assumptions and they're doing good things with their concern of the environment, but then they can twist it in a fallen direction, so that you have Prince Philip of England saying, in the event that I'm reincarnated, I would like to return as a deadly virus in order to contribute something to solve overpopulation. So he'd rather have a pristine universe and wipe the people off of it, because pristine nature is more important than humans, of course. So what are our purposes as Christians for doing science? Well, first of all, general revelation declares the glory of God, and we should revel in who God is, and we can discover the glory of God. Even in this earth that has been marred by the fall, we can discover the glory of God. The creation declares God's eternal power, his divinity, and we should recognize it, because as Christians, we don't, or we aren't supposed to, suppress the truth like unbelievers will do, according to Romans 1. We should glory in who God is as we look at the universe around us. And we should also love our neighbor. The greatest commandments are what? Love God and love your neighbor. And science is a tool that we can use for fulfilling this command to love our neighbor, whether it's in environmentalism, done in a correct way to take care of this earth, or whether it's in scientific discoveries to heal diseases, or it's the doctors who are doing their daily jobs of trying to keep people healthy. There's all kinds of different scientific and technological disciplines that we can use to help people and to do good for them. Now, we have about 4 minutes to go through the creational norm, so I'm just going to touch on these. But what makes, how do we do science? How do we operate doing the discipline of science according to God's creational norms, the way he designed this world to function? Well, the first norm is organized empirical study. We use our five senses. We look at the predictability of God's world, and we try to figure out things and maximize this world for its usefulness. We use technological tools to enhance this observation. We experiment thoroughly in different environments and with various factors. We're using our minds and our observation to systematize, to put all this knowledge together, and to understand how this world functions and how it operates. This is extremely important. I wish I had more time to get into this. But scientists often recognize this first norm, that they're doing all this organized study, inductively figuring things out, solving problems in this world. They're often blind to this norm, and that's the model making. Data is not just brute facts. Data is always understood, interpreted through a philosophical understanding. You really cannot do science without philosophical assumptions. So all data from observations gets fed into this model of understanding, this interpretation. And the more complex the model, the more complex the data, the more complex the model is. And what we're really doing as Christians with the evolutionary model of interpretation is we're challenging their philosophy and saying, no, that's not just brute empiricism that you're doing here. That's interpretive philosophy, and we challenge your philosophy. We're challenging your interpretation, and there's a different model that we present. And if we're just depending on human models, again, humans are finite and fallible and whatnot. Let me see how much time I have here, because I know I'm running out. I've got about 2 minutes. This might seem obvious, but if you think back to why did science progress so well, and the scientists here can tell me the exact history, because I'm just going off the top of my head, but 1600s, 1700s, before that time, you lacked communication. So what happens when people have to start all over from scratch themselves because they don't know what other people have discovered? You have to start all over, and you make little progress. But when you have communication, then you can access what other people have discovered and what they've understood, and you can build off of what they've already discovered, and you can progress. So collective knowledge is pretty important for science. Standardization is just as important for communication. In order to communicate well so that you can be understood, scientists have to speak the same language, and I wish I could go more into that. And the final one is that you can have no truth without goodness and beauty. Just because we have the technology that enables us to do something doesn't mean that we ought to do it. And this is where you get into bioethics. Is this good? Is this moral? There are ethical boundaries to what we do. And even is it beautiful? This is not necessarily a necessity, but think of a highway system and you use science and whatnot to figure out how all the roads should intersect. Well, beautify it with plants. It enhances the work. That's just one example. The last slide is that science is fallen. And I'm not going to get too far into this, but science is frustrated by the fall. It makes our work of science difficult because we're finite and fallible. Science is diverted because fallen scientists operate off of a false philosophy, and so they're trying to solve problems that don't exist or explain things that just is foolishness. Science has to study a fallen world. Why are we trying to fix the problems that we're fixing? Because of fallenness. Science is often mistrusted by people. They buy into conspiracy theories, or they just won't accept what the knowledgeable, studied community of scientists are telling us. And, of course, that community of scientists, they're fallen too, right? So they can be wrong. Science can be exalted, like they're gods, like they're unbiased, like they're infallible. So all of these are ways that science can be affected by the fall.